Mike Englebee might seem an odd choice as the narrative voice of a novel. He's a student when the story opens at what he describes as his ancient university, transparently Cambridge. He has a memory of both peculiar power and porousness. He can remember whole tracts of text, yet he forgets whole days. He confides in soaring monologues, but he conducts conversation curtly. Englebee develops a crush on a classmate named Jennifer Arkland, and one day she goes missing and is never found. As the years go on, Mike Englebee becomes a journalist in London. He has a name and friends, yet the memory of Jennifer, and a sense that her disappearance cheated him out of a true love, stays strong in Englebee until one day the past is dug up. Englebee is the title of this new novel by Sebastian Fox. Mr. Fox is one of Britain's most honored novelists, the author of Birdsong, Charlotte Gray, and other books. He joins us from our studios in London. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
What are some of the particular demands of having a narrator who has both total recall and unaccountable lapses?
Well, it's a bit of a gift to you as an author because you can give him quite unfeasibly amusing and also slightly disturbing recall of detail. And his lapses, you may choose as the reader to think that he's not being entirely truthful with you about his lapses. Is it really feasible that someone who has a memory of almost sort of autistic savant order over some things should really not remember other rather straightforward things?
I want to give our listeners a chance to honestly to enjoy some of the narrative quality in here, Mike Englebee's voice. And this is a speech that he confides to the readers. He says, it's 6:30 Monday, November 19, 1973.
Don't patronize me if you read this 30 years on, will you? Don't talk crap about the 70s, will you, as we now do about the 40s. I'm as modern as you are in my way. My reality is as complex as yours. And you too, on your front edge of breaking time, Mr. 2003, will be the object of condescending curiosity to the future, to Ms. 2033. So don't patronize me. Unless, of course, you have completely overturned and improved my world, bringing peace and plenty and a cure for cancer and schizophrenia, in which case you would be permitted to patronise primitive little 1973. Well, how's your 2003 world then? A few wars, some genocide, some terrorism? Yet you've had an extra 30 years to sort it out. What you get in that extract I just read is a sense of Mike, much of what he says you agree with, but it's just that he goes a little bit too far.
Mike Englebee essentially teaches himself to be a journalist, and he finds it appallingly easy.
Yes, he does. He doesn't receive any training in the art of journalism, but he figures the way to do it is to go along and ask people some questions and write down the answers that they give, or do the same thing by telephone. Make sure that they're accurate, and then string them together in some sort of narrative order so that they all make sense. Mm-hmm. Type it out and go to the pub. He doesn't understand why people have such difficulty in getting things right and accurate. And when, indeed, professional journalists, when he's a student, write reports in the newspapers of the disappearance of his friend Jennifer from university, he takes great pleasure in listing the extraordinary numbers of errors and inaccuracies in the reports, even by the big, grown-up, serious newspapers.
Mm. We have to point out, of course, you were a journalist, were a journalist of many years standing at the Telegraph, at the Independent. I think you wrote a column for the Guardian.
That's true, yeah.
Do you take some peculiar pleasure in pointing out the many lapses and omissions and mistakes of journalists here?
Yes, it always struck me as a journalist. I worked a lot for Sunday newspapers, which follow a story which has been done by a daily newspaper on, say, a Wednesday or a Thursday, when the reporter frequently hasn't had much time and is up against a deadline and has just banged in 400 or 500 words. But as a Sunday paper, you have time to go down there, spend 2 or 3 days in this place and really get to the bottom of it. But I would frequently arrive in some place holding a little cutting from the Times or wherever it might be and find that the proposed new railway through the middle of the cathedral was not actually a railway but a motorway. And it wasn't the cathedral, it was the hospital, and that those who were said to be for it were against it and so on. The whole thing was completely wrong from top to bottom. And this never ceased to amaze me.
What if journalism translates to or supports writing a good novel and what doesn't? What do you have to set aside?
I think what was helpful for journalism was I found out how easy it is to discover things and how easy it was to get beyond your own narrow life and experience. And you could find out about people and their lives in other countries, in other periods, and so on. And to me, that was the sort of big breakthrough when I began to write novels, which had experiences in them which were not mine.
And that's part of the fun of novels, too, isn't it? That you can identify with people who
yes, absolutely. You can put yourself in the mind of people that you wouldn't normally, and you can go for the ride, and you can go take yourself into psychological territory that you're otherwise not capable of entering. That's what I have done or tried to do with Engleby, is to take people into areas of thought and being which are very thrilling and very disturbing and very funny. And very disorientating, because a mixture of being thrilled and disturbed and made to laugh is not normal. You don't normally get inside someone else's mind like that.
Mid-novel, you realize that Mike Engleby has memorized some of the diaries of Jennifer Arkland, his disappeared friend. Are we meant to find this creepy?
You're meant to be a little worried about this. Mike tells you quite candidly that he has taken her diary away from her room. Mm-hmm. He intends to return it. But even so, taking someone's diary is a slightly worrying thing to do in the first place.
Particularly when there's a criminal case involved.
That's right.
He comes to view the diary kind of like the works of a great master. Vermeer, I think, is the analogy he has, that you've got these limited, finite works and you commit them to memory.
Yes, what Mike loves about Jennifer's journal is that she has a take on life and an ability to understand life, which he doesn't. Mm-hmm. Jennifer is a very outgoing, happy young woman, not sort of mindlessly happy, she is thoughtful as well, but she is able to engage with other people and engage mm-hmm. with the world in a constructive way, which Mike isn't. And I think he has a kind of rage or envy. He is drawn to her because he's attracted to her, that's for sure, but he wants something that she's got. He wants to have it. He wants to consume it and own it in some way. And what he wants from her is this natural balance, this something which I see in some people seem to have of what Mike called a flair for living. And it's something you see, I think, more often in women than in men, actually. But mm-hmm. And I certainly see this in a lot of people I know, that I would count myself among the sort of great majority of people who aren't really naturally terribly at home in this existence, but we've worked very hard to sort of make an accommodation with it and get on with it as best we can. But Jennifer is someone for whom the world seems almost to have been tailor-made.
So he worships this and yet also somehow resents it.
Yes, he deeply resents it, because Mike, as we learn more and more as the book goes along, although he has considerable powers of self-expression, he is not someone who connects well with the world at all.
We don't want to obviously give away any particularly important plot points, but let's just say that Jennifer's disappearance is not a settled matter.
It's not a settled matter, no. Mm-hmm. And we have to live with it as Mike does. And it raises all sorts of questions, or it does certainly in Mike's mind, about the past and to what extent we as mature human beings are connected in any way with what we were when we were children or teenagers. This is really, I suppose, what Engleby is really about, this whole idea of whether human beings are consistent and predictable characters as we are used to thinking of ourselves, mm-hmm. or whether we're actually unstable and provisional. And I think a lot of what we do is habit and memory. Probably memory is the key, is that which provides the sort of continuity in most normal people.
Separately, I've read recently that you're the author of the next James Bond novel.
You have read correctly, or truly. It must have been a very good newspaper which reported that so accurately. This came up about a year or so ago. I was summoned by Ian Fleming's family, who pointed out it was Ian Fleming's centenary next year, and how would I like to write a special novel commissioned by them to mark that centenary. So I went away and I read the Ian Fleming books, and I enjoyed them much more than I thought I would. And I then read an article which Ian Fleming had written in about 1960 called How to Write a Thriller. Well, I hadn't the first idea how to write a thriller. I don't particularly like them. But this told you how to do it. Write 2,000 words a day, go snorkeling, have a few martinis, have some beautiful women round for dinner, 1,000 words in the morning, 1,000 words in the evening.
This sounds great.
Well, that's what I thought. Also, I figured out if I wrote 2,000 words a day, I could write the whole story in 6 weeks. So I followed his prescription, and I wrote it in 6 weeks, and it was great, great fun to do, and that's coming out next May.
Yeah, Devil May Care is the title,
that's
right?
What it's called, Devil May Care, yeah.
And may I ask, because a serious novelist, Mr. Fox, are you reconciled to the fact that a few months from now, whenever you appear, people will go, da-da-da-da-da-da-da?
Yes, it happened to me in a restaurant in London night before last. I was going over to a table and holding a glass of wine, and the literary editor of The Observer, which is a Sunday newspaper in London, a very distinguished one, looked into my glass and said, "Shaken, not stirred, I presume."
Sebastian Fox's new novel is Engleby, speaking with us from London. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. I've enjoyed it.
And you can read an excerpt from Engleby, if you dare, at npr.org/books. And if you come to our website at npr.org, you can sign up for our weekend edition podcast called At Your Leisure.